Hello and welcome to the Ship.Energy podcast. This is Mark Williams, broadcasting to you from Cambridgeshire in the UK. Now, on the last 2.5 years that we've been running the Ship.Energy podcast, we've had plenty of guests on to talk about marine fuels, about new technology, about regulations, about new vessel designs. But we haven't yet heard in all that time from the people at the sharp end, from the seafarers themselves. And I thought it was about time we put that right. So my guest this week is someone who has been a seafarer himself. He spent a decade working as a navigation officer, mostly on cable ships. He has a chief officer certificate and a master's degree in marketing and communications and another one in international relations. So this is a man who's widely traveled, who's a great communicator, who understands and expresses the concerns of seafarers around the world to his audience. He's the author of a number of books for the Nautical Institute and for the IMO on a wide range of maritime issues. He's past president of the Liverpool branch of the Propeller Club. He's an associate fellow of the Nautical Institute and a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts. In the last few years, he founded the Seafarers Happiness Index, working with the Mission to Seafarers. The aim of the project is to produce data and insight from seafarers, finding the mechanisms to address concerns of the crews, ensuring that the voice of those at sea is heard. So my guest today is Stephen Jones, and we're going to be talking about the training requirements for seafarers with regards to low and zero carbon fuels, and talk about how seafarers are recovering from the difficulties of the pandemic, how they're dealing with the threat to their roles from autonomy, one of the twin processes of decarbonisation, and how they're coping with geopolitical uncertainty and conflict. Amidst all of that, there is the rising debate around decarbonisation. So let's get on to with Stephen to hear his clear voice from the bridge on the practical challenges that lie ahead. Stephen, welcome to the show. Great to have you on.
Mark, good to see you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's a delight. Always a delight to see you. And missed you last week at Marine Money in London because I couldn't go to that. So tell us about the Seafarer Happiness Index that you've been working on.
Yep, thanks. So the Seafarer Happiness Index is a project that I work on with the Mission to Seafarers. And we basically ask seafarers the world over how they feel about their life at sea. It's as simple or as complicated as that. 10 questions that kind of span what we kind of think captures the kind of spread of interests. So ranging from the fundamentals of how happy seafarers feel through issues such as connectivity, food on board, health and fitness, shore leave, wages, workload, the interactions they have on board, and access to welfare. And in answering those questions, marking each out of 10, we kind of build a data picture of how people are feeling at sea. But more importantly than that, for each question, they actually have the opportunity to tell us more about it, to actually kind of share their thoughts, and that gets woven together as a kind of narrative to capture some of the kind of experiences that seafarers are going through. I think really the genesis of it all was the fact that it's too easy to either ignore those at sea or too difficult to kind of really get their input onto what's going on and what the realities are. So it's hopefully a mechanism that allows us to mesh the gears, so ashore with what goes on and then with the realities out at sea.
And I want to sort of tie this into our general decarbonisation theme for ship energy. Of course, there's a whole raft of new technologies that are being brought on board. You know, we've got smart ships, we've got connectivity, we've got scrubbers, we've got new non-engine technologies, air lubrication of hulls and so on. And presumably all the seafarers have to be trained in all of this. How does adapting to all that new technology and how does access to training affect them on their happiness index? Can you quantify that with the work you do?
Yeah, a little. I mean, you know, the humanization of decarbonization is a kind of side challenge issue that's going on. Throughout the happiness index, certainly on the training side of things, we've started to notice more responses. And these are particularly from engineers just starting to talk about the fact that they feel slightly out of the loop on this. They hear and read and all the rest of it kind of talk of the new training that will be needed and the demands on them, and as seafarers and as engineers, what they'll be doing with these new wonderful fuel mixes, etc., etc. But don't feel actually pulled into the debate. They don't feel there's obvious training planned or in place. And all of a sudden, back in the Phoenicians and the Romans, the hybrid approach with rowing and sails through to the sailing ships, through to steam and coal, and now, you know, oil, and then the next iteration. I think at every point we were kind of preparing seafarers for that change, or it was so obvious of the ways of moving forward. But at the moment, because there's so many potential solutions in the mix, it's not clear to seafarers where they're going to fit in. And then I think parallel to that, you know, the constant debate about, well, there'll be no seafarers anyway, you're all going to be autonomous ships. And so I think that's further clouding it as well. So I don't think there's a very clear picture at the moment. It doesn't feel like there's a plan either.
Now, there's sort of regulated training that seafarers have to go through. Is there anything coming through from the regulators about the new technologies and how seafarers can get new tickets for those?
Well, I mean, I think at the moment it's all kind of held slightly in an awkward orbit around each other. You know, while the talk and the discussions at the likes of the International Maritime Organization, etc., are going on about what fuels or what, you know, what mechanisms will be introduced to reduce emissions, those debates are still, you know, rattling around and rumbling on. And so until they're pinned down, it's then you're only really able to talk in a very generic sense about, oh, and of course the people charged with actually making this happen and work will need such and such, or they'll need to know how to use this, or how to plug that in, or pump that, or clean that up if it spills, etc. So I think there's a lag at the moment, but the kind of wider narrative and debate and discussion on all the things that we need to do is outstripping the bureaucracy, the kind of political talk, and the kind of the mud that they're climbing through to produce the actual plan, processes, systems, and everything that we'll need to make sure we have people with the skills, knowledge to make this actually happen.
And when you talk to seafarers, and when you presumably get some sort of comment back as well as the data from these guys, do you get any view about, or do you get any visibility of their views about the different fuels, you know, methanol, ammonia, fuel cells, and so on?
It hasn't really been something that we've asked yet. I mean, it's certainly a good one, and I think something to be kind of bandied around. And I think as the Seafarers Happiness Index kind of evolves, then giving seafarers those platforms to debate and discuss are really valuable. I mean, I would hope that at the moment, the kind of the real positive platforms for those type of debates will be the likes of the Nautical Institute for more on the deck side, and maybe the IMRS on the marine engineering side of things. So really the kind of more professional body led holistic approach of the options and how they fit in. And then that kind of translates into those on the front line being able to have views. At the moment, I think it's just too bewildering. You know, the pressure's on a seafarer to get their existing ship from where they are to where it's needed, safely, clean, you know, optimized, and all these other wonderful things, holding back the kind of pressures of digitalization and you know, oh, are we going to be hacked today? You know, what cyber threats are we going through? You know, thankfully, piracy is quiet, so that's one slight less thing to worry about at the moment. But the sheer demands on crews at the moment to face reality is hard enough. To then kind of try and have them anticipating a future that we just don't seem to have confidence in, it is not really going to fly or float.
It sounds like there's going to be a real crunch point coming up in the next few years, as you know, when someone's going to accept new technology. You know, Maersk have their methanol ships. There are now ammonia-ready designs on the drawing board, and we'll come from the shipyards in the next few years. At some point then, somebody's going to have to grasp the nettle here and get a bunch of seafarers who are prepared to trade up on these vessels and get them operating on them.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the things that's always come across, and I think, you know, I'm from a long line of seafarers, great-grandfathers, grandfather's father, etc., and I'm myself a former seafarer. I think what always shines through is that kind of pragmatic approach and view of things. You know, I will deal with the thing when I need to deal with it. There's no need to kind of alter course too early, because that in itself causes its own problems. So I think you've got the experienced people sat there waiting for the passage plan, if you like, to keep it nautical, of where they need to go and what training they need and what the expectations are. And you know, and I think going back to the autonomous debate, I think one of the real problems at the moment is that seafarers, say the slightly more senior ones with maybe, you know, 15 years of experience under their belt, likely serving as chief or second engineer or in that structure, they're starting to think, well, does the autonomy kind of debate mean that I won't have a job? Am I now looking to shift ashore? Am I going to change my career? And if I am, maybe I'm not going to be the one that's running the engines when it's running on whatever, or maybe I'm not the one that's going to be hooked up to a kite or having bubbles emit from my bow as I push serenely through the water. So I think at the moment we've got this absolute problem sticking point of no one really taking the lead and no one even knowing who's meant to be led. So we're at a real kind of turning point at the moment, and time is absolutely of the essence.
So I guess that has very specific effects on morale.
Yeah, totally. I mean, one of the things that's kind of come out of the happiness index over the past couple of years, as you might expect, is the terrible impact of COVID, not just from a physically health perspective, but mentally. The fact that shore leave has been eroded to such an extent that it feels like a kind of historical high watermark that people actually got to go ashore. So, you know, seafarers are feeling isolated. They thankfully, the crew change issue seems to be resolving itself, and there's a bit more certainty. Certainly in the happiness index, we've seen the data rise. People seem more satisfied as the world's opened back up, as there is that certainty. But it's very unclear as to how their morale is going to be shaped by this. The minute they start to feel irrelevant, the minute they start to feel ignored or not listened to or not part of the debate, then that's where you get the problems arise. And I think at the moment, seafarers generally are kind of slightly aloof from the debate because they don't know where it's going. So, you know, well, you crack on with your methane over there and ammonia, whatever. I guess we'll see what comes and then I'll have to decide. So at the moment, everyone's held in a slight stasis. They know it's coming. The change is there, but because they don't quite know in what direction it's coming, and of course, who's going to pay for it? You know, if I was an engineer now thinking, right, well, I must go on some courses about methanol, well, A, would I really want to throw my money at that in case the next ship wasn't going to be, et cetera? And what is out there anyway? So at the moment, we're very much in a holding pattern about what the realities are going to translate into. And of course, maybe by then, it's going to be too late.
Well, there's certainly that risk, isn't there, that there'll be a shortfall of trained engineers in particular by the time the new technology comes on, and then there's going to be a scramble for them. Great for the ones who are in the market, presumably, because their salaries will go up from their money. You know, they'll be in demand. Like LNG captains were hugely in demand, and their salaries went up. But you know, most ships are crewed via crewing agencies and ship managers these days. So presumably the burden of training is going, providing training or arranging training is going to fall on those individuals and those organizations. Do you ever speak to any of them? Do you have any indication about how they're approaching?
Definitely. You know, the chains of relationship between a person stood on a ship and the actual boardroom of a shipping company have become over the years incredibly stretched and at times strained. So it isn't obvious, kind of, you know, that relationship between a ship owner and the seafarer. At every point, that means complication. At every point, that means cost. I think at every point, that potentially means poor communication. You know, it turns into almost the kind of Chinese whispers of things along the line. And ultimately, you have a ship owner who needs that person, that seafarer stood on their ship. And sometimes the message isn't getting along through terribly well. As you tend to get more kind of commercial links in the chain, then everything becomes about the money aspect. And unfortunately, those middle bits of the crewing agent, etc., they're not that concerned about the wider esoteric solutions. They just want to have what they need to be able to satisfy the client up the chain. I think at the moment they still can, because the debate is rumbling on around them. But there will become that point when someone sat in an office in Cyprus or wherever goes, "Ooh, I could really do with 20 engineers who know how to deal with methane and methanol or ammonia, etc." And they just can't find them. And then that will be the point, as shipping traditionally always has done, is waited until it's on the rocks or the stuff has hit the fan. And
we wait till the last possible moment. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. We're a reactive industry in the main.
Yeah. I mean, we've already got the case, with training, that things like, we had to get new skills for ships engineers for things like Tier 3 and NOx compliant engines, for handling scrubbers, for heavy, high sulfur fuel oil, or for handling very low sulfur fuel oil, because that has different storage and treatment and handling requirements and specifications. Presumably, the training and the certification has changed for engineers to address those issues, but not necessarily certainly. I don't know. Have you got any insight on that?
I think we've kind of probably over the past 10 years entered a phase of constant change and tinkering and improvement. And I think seafarers more than ever, that focus on continuing professional development has been one that's come ever more to the fore. I think the old idea that you qualified and then for 20 years you just did the same thing constantly doesn't really apply, and seafarers don't think in those terms anymore. There is that constant demand, whether it's been the evolution of all the kind of electronic navigation through to digitalization, through to, as you say, all the different challenges of making these different engines work, do, deliver, produce, and then emit what you need them to do. So I think we're in a good position insofar as people are more adaptable and open to change and take the steps that they need. That's become the norm. It's just that I don't think people honestly know where to step to next. The kind of stepping stones across their kind of career path, if you like, aren't well enough defined, and I don't think they fully know where to jump to. One of the interesting things that came across and was mentioned a few times in the latest Seafarers Happiness Index was seafarers making the move from deep sea to short sea or coastal trades. I think the kind of message, sometimes a little reading between the lines, was that the uncertainties of COVID and crew changes, etc., rattled them so much and perhaps rattled their families back at home, that the decision was made, remain as a seafarer at the moment, but kind of change the types of ships and move closer to shore to hopefully kind of insulate themselves a little bit geographically from these kind of problems. So people will make the jump. They will do the right things for their career, for their lives, etc. But from this training perspective and development, I just don't see that the paths are quite clear enough at the moment.
That element of insight that you've drawn from the happiness index, that seafarers are considering staying closer to home, so going into short sea services or going into coastal or going into offshore type services, that's going to have long-term repercussions potentially then, because Nigel Draffin, who some listeners may know, who if you've been to a ship energy conference or a Petrospot conference, you've probably seen Nigel, or if you've had any Petrospot training, you may have been trained by Nigel. You may have read one of his Petrospot books. But he said at a ship energy conference last year that we're going to be short of 75,000 engineers by 2025, which is pretty much one for every vessel. And the shortfall is increasing, he says, by 8,000 a year, because the average age of engineers keeps going up, and it's now into the 50s. So as engineers in particular are getting older,
senior navigating officers are getting older, and but engineers and navigating officers and all the way down to deckhands want to stay closer to shore. We must be sort of teetering towards or at a cliff edge of where there just aren't going to be the seafarers available to man all the vessels.
I think we definitely are, and I think that's certainly, you know, the issue of engineers has always been a slightly more intriguing one than even on the deck side, because engineering more readily translates ashore. So all of a sudden, you kind of have that double-edged demand as well, is that if an engineer isn't particularly happy at sea, then they can think about moving ashore more readily. And I think we have started to see that. I think this move into kind of short sea or coastal trade is also an interesting one, because that's where it's most likely that the autonomy will first kick in as well. So all of a sudden, seafarers are moving into the arena that autonomy is more readily going to be in. And then you've got that. So then are we just going to see that whole swathe of seafarers again wiped out and lost because they don't want to go back to deep sea? I think this is, we really are climbing along the seesaw towards the tipping point at a very worryingly kind of rapid rate with no real joined up approach. I mean, and that's always been one of seafaring's issues, that there's no one at the wheel. It's just, you know, it finds its own route forward. And in the main, we, you know, we get regulations, etc., that have been slightly more kind of reactive in nature. But this training issue and these gaps, I think, you know, these need addressing now as a matter of urgency. And I guess, you know, in the interim, I suppose a kind of hybrid model of preparing engineers for different fuels is perhaps the route forward, to give us at least a baseline to move forward, that, you know, this is a future fuels training approach, whatever, who knows what you'll be dealing with, but at least you've started to think about it, and then you can kind of more readily be plugged in to the actual solutions that your actual company, your career, etc., looks like pursuing. So I think there is need for that, really.
So I wonder who's going to provide all the new training courses.
Well, yeah. you can hear the sprint of the companies.
All the training providers, yeah, sort of dashing to create these new courses for people. So well, be good news for the, does Hugh Baird provide that kind of training up in Bootle?
I think they have had port stuff. I mean, there's, you know, there's lots of the universities that have the mix, but, you know, university courses tend to be a long time in the making. You know, the training's great and it sticks with people, but it takes a long time to get there. I think we're probably at the point of needing a more agile preparatory approach to the learning, almost like a foundation level on future fuels. So everyone at least then is having some foundation basis that they can climb up from, instead of at the moment the kind of rolled eyes about some, or, you know, whatever. It's very difficult to be on the edge of these conversations. You know, if you think about yourself as a car owner, you know, we switch to electric now or whatever, and you don't really know where to invest or what to do. And it's exactly the same with seafarers and their careers. Well, what do we do? What do we invest in? Do I do training in this? You know, oh, yeah. And then all of a sudden, nuclear's being bandied around as well. And it's almost kind of quite bewildering, to the extent where I guess the answer has been, well, let's see. You know, the best advice I ever got at sea when I was a navigating officer going into kind of busy waters and you see ships and whatever is, you know, have a look, go away, make yourself a coffee, come back, and 90% of the problems will have sorted themselves out. And you're a bit more obvious about what you need to fix. So I think in many respects, seafarers at the moment are just sipping their coffee, waiting for the reality to fall in front of them, and then they'll know what to do, what to invest in. You know, a lot of seafarers have to pay for their own training. So this can be a really expensive investment in themselves, and they have to choose very wisely, because the wrong spend, then it's just money wasted and they can't, you know, pursue the career that they need or deserve.
Well, that goes some way to answering what my next question was going to be, was there's a cost involved in all of this, and who's going to bear that cost? And so the ship owners, not necessarily, because they don't necessarily provide all of their own seafarers. the third party managers, not necessarily, because they may not have training contracts with the people they supply to the ship operating companies. The seafarers in the end have to pay for their own training to some extent.
I mean, I think what we're position, I guess, that we're edging towards is because it's been so difficult to predict what the actual fuel will be, then it's so difficult to predict the training. So we're perhaps further behind than we would be on any other kind of issue. And I guess what the approach might have to be is International Chamber of Shipping were proponents of this research and development fund that everyone put into to try and find the right fuels. I suspect maybe a similar approach will be needed in training, that, you know, the need is so great, the acceleration needed is so great, the only way to really get everyone through will be to have everyone putting in, basically, and have that kind of, you know, a training fund for fuels pulled together, and then we can get all the seafarers that we need through that and move forward.
So if the IMO does come up with a carbon levy, then hypothecate some of the income raised from that to put into a trading fund. Well, it sounds like a great idea in principle. Although I'm still slightly confused as to if the IMO starts imposing a carbon levy and the IMO switches its role to become a tax collector, where does the money go and who allocates it and on what policies and principles and how is it all accounted for? It sounds to me like the IMO switches from being a parliament to being an executive, and that's a significant change in its role.
Yeah, I mean, and that's where these new type of problems throw up new kinds of problems, and I think exactly that. The relationship, you know, I've been seeing in work I've been doing around the ports and terminal side of things, you know, that the future of shipping and its relationships with everything it interacts with is changing. You know, a port used to be just a wall that you went in and pretty much, you know, as long as its cranes worked or whatever, then no one really cared. But all of a sudden, the relationship from a port, well, it has to be able to provide the power that you need to plug you in. It has to provide all the various things that a port didn't necessarily have to consider in so many different ways. And I guess, you know, in the same way as the relationship between the ship and a port is changing, it seems like the relationship between shipping and its regulatory bodies is changing as well. And that evolution, particularly, you know, the IMO becomes the focus of shipping too easily and too readily, because that's all we've got to look to. And it always seems to be the answer, whatever the question. But the reality of it is, of course, as a UN specialized body, and the fact that it, you know, has to reflect what its member states tell it to do, then it's fallen into a kind of a strange position of half admin, half bureaucracy, half rule setting, half checking, half vetting, half, you know, it's trying to be so many things to so many sides and equations within the industry, which is a stretch at best.
Setting it up to fail, isn't it? If it's doing, I think they counted six halves there. So yeah,
that's
getting into the realms of quantum regulation, I think, at that point. But yeah. So let's wind this up. If nothing changes, where are we going to be in 5 years' time? You know, the Seafarer Index was, what was it, 7 point something at the start of this year?
Well, the very latest report that I've just released was a bit of a high watermark. So we've reached 7.69 out of 10 across the board, which has steadily been increasing through 2022 as things got better. So that's great. I always worry, because I'm a pessimist by nature, that that's the highest we'll reach. And, you know, the reality is that a lot of things have combined. We've had the kind of the micro elements on board ship that companies have improved. So little things like improving facilities on board, better gym equipment, better connectivity, you know, movie nights, etc. So the nice changes that were made. And then all of a sudden, we've got better at providing shore leave and crew change, and those macro elements away from the vessel have got better. And that's the reflection of where we've got to now, a fairly high watermark of sentiment. You know, these things can go up as well as down. But the suspicion for me is the changing relationship between seafarers and their careers is what will happen next. It won't necessarily be their happiness about their life on that particular ship with that particular crew, with that particular experience, it'll be a more holistic view that they take of their lives, of their careers. And, you know, everyone ashore through COVID or whatever has probably rethought the way that they run their lives from a career perspective, from everything. And that's what's happening. So I think the shortfalls that we hear about today are only going to increase. And so if we don't get a clear direction of travel, clear support, clear engagement, it's all about communication at the end of the day, and, you know, and empathy. And shipping companies, manning agents, ship managers, etc., that know they need seafarers in place to deliver things, have to be talking about the tools to allow them to do that. And I think that's the missing part of the jigsaw at the moment. I've always thought, and it's made me kind of wryly smile, that autonomous ships and all the systems and all the equipment on board are going to deliver fantastic things and never break down and never be demanding and never say, oh, the temperature's not right on board, or the conditions aren't right for me to operate, so I'm just going to down tools and wait for someone to come and fix me. You know, seafarers have always carried on in the face of adversity, and we're at a real point of adversity now, and we might be losing seafarers. So, you know, we have a very difficult balancing act to come. We have to reduce our emissions. We have to be clean and green and do all these wonderful things to decarbonize. But the message and the reality on the ships isn't necessarily translating to reassure seafarers of their careers moving forward.
Well, that message has come through loud and clear. So it was good to have you on to spell that out for us. So, Stephen Jones, thank you very much for appearing on the Ship Energy Podcast. And thank you to all out there in listener land. And tune in for another engaging conversation in the next episode. Thanks, and bye from Cambridge.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, everyone.